It's another hour of In Deep. I'm Angie Claro. The Republican Party and the right, well, they've got a problem. The policies and proposals they love alienate as many, maybe more people than they actually attract. So what does the right do to overtly reach out and covertly undermine minorities and LGBT citizens? And how does a gay man run as a Republican? Fred Karger and more coming up on In Deep. Music me. It sounds vaguely familiar. Oh, yeah. There she is. It's Gotta Laugh with her usual skewed political view of the news.
Yes.
It's our Buttercup.
I've come up with a brand new cure for insomnia.
Oh, yeah.
It's so easy. Why nobody thought of this before, honestly? You close your eyes and you count how many cars fit into Mitt Romney's car elevator. It's so obvious. You just sit there and go on forever until you fall asleep.
He went out of his way this week to prove how out of touch he is with the average American. The car elevator was just the beginning.
Oh, my God. A lobbyist dedicated to getting officials to renovate his home. Unbelievable. The thing is not that he's wealthy and that, oh, my God, how out of touch he is because he's wealthy, because there are wealthy politicians who are not out of touch.
Yes, exactly. But you know, he's Romney. He's out of touch.
Yeah, exactly. He's just clueless. As you said earlier to me today, he's absolutely clueless. He has no way to connect with his human side. And he sees everything politically. He doesn't get it. The newest is he was on this conference call with thousands of Wisconsin voters. And he comes up with a little nostalgia moment that he called humorous. He said it. We didn't. And do you have the clip of this or do you want me to just read what he said?
Why don't you go ahead and read what he says?
Okay. He goes, one of the most humorous moments I think relates to my father. You may remember my father, George Romney, was president of an automobile company called American Motors. They had a factory in Michigan and they had a factory in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and another one in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And as the president of the company, he decided to close the factory in Michigan and move all the production to Wisconsin. Now, later, he decided to run for governor of Michigan, and so you can imagine that having closed that factory and moved all the production to Wisconsin was a very sensitive issue to him for his campaign. And so he starts recalling this parade in which there was a school band marching with his dad's campaign that they only knew the Wisconsin fight song. They didn't know the Michigan fight song. So he goes on to say, so every time they would start playing On Wisconsin, my dad's political people would jump up and down and try to get them to stop. But they didn't want people in Michigan to be reminded that my dad had moved to the production to Wisconsin.
Isn't that a riot? This is a weird, weird. How can he find that funny for these people?
Aren't unemployed people funny to you?
Maybe there's something wrong with me.
And I bet yesterday he rented two of his Cadillacs to his servants and thought that was funny too. It's just insane. Honestly, the guy, and then you do have the clip of him making fun of John Kerry. I know that.
Yeah, we do. You want to hear that? Here is Mitt Romney going off on John Kerry.
There's a senator from my state you may have heard that wants to get elected president. And I don't know why he wants to do that, because, of course, if he won, he'd have to move into a smaller house. But,
What's that old thing about when you point a finger at somebody, they're four pointing back at you?
Four houses pointing back at him, in fact. That was a 2004 speech, and he was at the Republican Governors Association, and here is the king of houses talking about a guy that has a house. You know, talking about his two Cadillacs and the right-sized trees, and who knows what else he says. Mr. Etch-a-Sketch has got to reshake himself again, because that was just wrong. He doesn't remember that we actually record things. People have these things called recorders, and you can play them back anytime you want.
You know, I think I'd feel better about the guy if I thought this was all because he was on drugs. It would make me like him more, but no, he's just stupid.
It would be an improvement, I can tell you that.
Okay, so if we want to take a break from the insanity of Mitt Romney, shall we look to Santorum instead?
There's no insanity there, huh? So he went bowling, and it turns out Sam Youngman, who's a campaign correspondent for Reuters, happened to catch him saying, and I'm quoting Rick Santorum, "You're not going to use the pink bowling ball. We're not going to let you do that. Not on camera," Santorum to a young fella bowling with him. Santorum picked up what somebody else was saying and continued on with, "Friends don't let friends use pink balls."
Well, yep. How many different ways shall we translate that?
Yeah, well, as Hypervocal, the site Hypervocal said, Rick Santorum only likes boys with blue balls.
Which explains his entire life.
it certainly does. You know, I'd like to know, first of all, other than the fact that he was encouraging, homophobic, discriminating, bullying type of attitude, I'd like to know why inanimate pink objects turn one gay. And I'd like to know, if there are gay colors, then there must be non-gay colors. And if there are non-gay colors, then if gay men wear them, do they turn straight?
That's probably more thought than he's ever get more introspection than he's ever given to anything he's ever done. Although, you know what our engineer Matt brought up, when you go to bowling alleys, a lot of times the balls they have available for rent are color coded. You pick it by weight. You know, if it's pink, you just overcome whatever issues you might have and pick up the right ball.
Yeah, I can't lift those things anyway. And here's the other thing, by the way, speaking of gay colors, the best part is that Rick Santorum wears pink ties, and there are pictures of him. So, he can talk about pink balls all he wants, and all of us will, in fact.
Which is why we bring you around here, Miss Laffey. Thank you for another excellent glimpse of the headlines.
Thank you.
Gotta laugh from thepoliticalcarnival.net. Hi, I'm Angie Cuero. This is In Deep. As this election gets closer, life for Republicans gets a wee bit complicated. On the trail, they slam Puerto Ricans for not speaking English, gay people for not being straight, women for having vaginas, non-Christians for believing the wrong things, and Hispanics because, of course, they have suspect immigration status. They just might be reducing the numbers that will flock to the booth for them. So this hour, we're looking at how the Republican right confronts two natural enemies, Hispanics and the gay population. They combine public overtures with fierce behind-the-scenes manipulation. In a few minutes, the covert divide-and-conquer strategy on gay marriage. But first, Republicans are stymied by the growing Latino population. Their numbers are too big to ignore. So among other tactics, the right fights to require picture IDs for voters. The Brennan Center for Justice points out as many as 11% of eligible voters don't have government-issue photo ID. Now, that percentage is even higher for people of color. Many find it hard to get the IDs because documentation can be difficult or expensive. The Nation says that's 23 million eligible voters who don't have picture ID. So that screens some of them out, but to reach those who will vote, the right has to engage them without alienating their conservative, often racist base. As an example, U.S. Latinos love the DREAM Act. It's a progressive plan that supports education and citizenship for young immigrants. Now, how can the right compete with that? Senator Marco Rubio popped up with a pseudo-DREAM Act, kind of a nightmare. Michael Keegan said in the Huffington Post that this would give young people a permanent second-class status. They'd be allowed to live and work and pay taxes in the U.S., but never be permitted the ability to vote or exercise full citizenship. So that's the balancing act on the right. You pit the blacks against the queers. You razzle-dazzle the naive brown people while making sure they don't get to outnumber the white folks at the polls. Charming. So let's tackle that latter part of the equation first. And the big challenge for Republicans is reaching out to constituencies that, in fact, their very policies at the very least offend and at worst can actually criminalize. The extreme nature of the Republican primary slate this season has set the party at odds with, well, let's see, we've got women, the LGBT communities, and immigrants, both legal and undocumented. So let's talk first about that latter segment of Americans. And for that, we're going to talk with Rui Teixeira. He is a senior fellow with both the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress. And he caught my eye when he participated in a print debate on the New York Times website, and it was in line with what the Democrats need to do for their Hispanic outreach. So we'll touch him with both parts of that conversation. Rui, thanks for taking time with us.
Sure, no problem.
So getting the Hispanic vote is important for both sides, just numerically. Now, some of the most recent polls have said that Hispanic participation in voting has shown its first drop in many, many years, but it's still a significant portion of the electorate. Do the Hispanics go to Democrats because it's the least of the two evils? Is there a natural attraction there? Or is just that the Republican policies are so repugnant? Where's the stance there?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, on the one hand, if you're obviously in terms of the overall immigration issue, Democrats are historically more on Hispanic side than the Republicans, are much more liberal and tolerant about it and more interested in actual reform of the system and not just rigid enforcement. So that helps them. And then if you look at a wide range of economic issues, Hispanics tend to be very sensitive to these economic issues, see the government as having an important role in addressing things like jobs and education, and that naturally tends to put them on the side of the Democrats. In fact, if you look at basic questions about the role of government, Hispanics are the most liberal group in the United States. They're even more liberal than blacks on some of these issues. So there's natural attraction in that sense, I think. But the other side of it, of course, is that the Republicans are doing everything they can to push away any Hispanic who might be interested in the Republican Party because of their, you know, pretty hostile stance in immigration, because of the way the candidates, for example, in the Republican primary have tended to one-up each other in terms of articulating their, you know, sort of hardline stance in immigration. Everybody's against the Dream Act. Everybody's against in-state tuition for kids of immigrants. Everybody, of course, isn't interested at all in a path to citizenship, and they just want to build a wall, you know, a wall ever higher between Mexico and the United States. So that's not a welcoming kind of message for most Hispanics. So they're tending now, I think, at this point, to see Republicans as the white people's party, and the Democrats as a party that's much more open to minorities in general, Hispanics in particular.
I think that's
a double whammy in terms of, you know, for the GOP. On the one hand, Hispanics attracted to the Democrats just generically, and on the other hand, they're pushing them away.
Well, although the Republicans have tried to make a dent in that, at least going to the Dream Act and Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, he has come out with what he essentially calls his version of the Dream Act, obviously an outreach attempt, but it guts the Democratic promotion of the Dream Act, because there's no real trail to the American Dream in that. But it does show they're making some kind of effort. Does it carry any weight that you have someone who's young, attractive, well-spoken, Marco Rubio in Florida, who's at least saying, gosh, I hear what your interests are and we're trying to address that? Do you think that carries any real weight?
I think pretty limited. I mean, this is a standard today's Republican Party strategy about Hispanics is, you know, it's strictly rhetorical, the kind of outreach. You know, they'll run Spanish language ads and they'll talk about an issue of concern to Hispanics, but talk about it in a way that's so different than what the Democrats are proposing and what most Hispanics want that it's almost silly. As I think the New York Times put it, the Rubio proposal is like the Dream Act without the dream. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, weird. I mean, why are they even bothering? But I think they hope just by talking the talk a little bit, they'll fool people. But I actually think it's going to be pretty difficult to get over on most Hispanic voters in that way. I think Rubio, you know, his real job, if he has one at this point for the Republicans, is strictly in Florida, I think. I think his national appeal is limited. However, if they do put him on the ticket, it would probably enhance the Republicans' chances of carrying Florida because of his appeal to Cuban Hispanics and, you know, sort of general native son kind of stuff. So I think that's important for them. I mean, if they can't carry Florida, they can't win this election. They can't win the presidential election. So, but I think Rubio and the kind of proposals he's making are in and of themselves drastically insufficient to change the image of the Republicans among Hispanics at large.
What about the appeal of some of the social issues? And to delineate some of those, we have, for example, there's a very big push for anti-abortion on the right side. It's a very anti-gay line of folks we have there on the Republican side. And some of the Hispanic Latino communities tend to be either Catholic or at least heavily Christian. And does this have, again, any appeal there?
Again, I think pretty limited. There are two things that are important to know about Latinos' views on social issues. One is that, by and large, they don't vote on those issues. It's been shown time and again that even where Latinos have conservative views on social issues, even those voters who do, they don't tend to vote on that basis. So in that sense, it doesn't do them a lot of good. And the second thing is the more people are, I think, less clear on, or even more confused, let's just say, is that Hispanics' views on social issues are not that conservative. If you look, for example, at their views on gay marriage, Hispanics, by and large, are about as liberal or non-liberal as, you know, you want to put, whichever way you want to put it, as non-Hispanic whites.
That does go against the conventional wisdom, yeah.
And in fact, the most conservative group, a race ethnic group on gay issues, are blacks. Mm-hmm. And obviously that hasn't moved them to vote Republican on that basis. And I think in the case of Hispanics, the hope that they'll vote on the basis of those issues for the Republican Party is even more misplaced.
One of the things we've talked about on the show, and we're talking about more this week, is the possible role of complacency in this election. There's a lot of belief out there that whoever the Republicans ultimately put up against Barack Obama, he has got the economy working in his favor. He's got the fact that no matter who shows up on the Republican side, it's going to be an extremist. And there's almost a fait accompli mentality that I'm hearing coming from some quarters. Is the Democratic Party in danger of taking for granted the Hispanic vote?
Well, I think there's always a danger of that. I think the way I read the tea leaves on this, I think they are taking it pretty seriously, and I think they have a outreach kind of machine being put in place and activated that I think is superior, or should, in a mechanical sense at least, should be superior to the one they had in 2008. And I think they'll get points for trying. I think the issue is whether they'll actually be able to get people to come out and vote, because they're really, it's very important for many reasons for Democrats, but not least is the fact that if the Democrats are going to get an increased share of voters who are minorities in this election, which is what the demographic trends would suggest, that's primarily going to come from Hispanics. So if Hispanics turn out at relatively low rates, that could really interfere with that. And that's, you know, the minority vote is obviously Obama's trump card in this election. So they need to have that as big as possible. They can't do it without Hispanics. But I don't see them being complacent about it. I mean, just because the economy has picked up a little bit, I think they realize this could be a very tough, probably will be a very tough election. Any election when the economy is overall this bad, despite the fact that it's been improving, I think the incumbents run scared. And I think they realize that they've got to give 110 from now until Election Day. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I don't see the evidence that they're taking any group of voters for granted, particularly Hispanics.
What about the fact that throughout America, when there's an effort to tamper with the vote, when phone calls are made at the last moment to say, hey, your voting place has changed, or there's leafleting saying, well, the date of voting has changed, normally, that tends to focus on neighborhoods where people are less educated and, in many cases, minorities, usually racial minorities. Do you think that has the danger of actually tampering with the real numbers of the vote with Hispanics?
Well, I think there is that possibility, and we know, of course, that beyond that, there's been a lot of effort, obviously led almost exclusively by the GOP, to put in place restrictions on people's ability to vote under the guise of trying to do something about the alleged problem of voter fraud, you know, this whole you can't vote unless you have 85 forms of photo ID and that sort of thing. So I think that's clearly targeted at less educated and minority voters. And, you know, that's being vigorously fought by the Justice Department. And I think there'll be a lot of counter-mobilization to try to deal with that problem. But I think it's a real one. And I think that it deserves to be taken pretty seriously.
Rui Teixeira, I really appreciate your time.
Sure. My pleasure.
Rui Teixeira is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's also co-author of The Emerging Democratic Majority and the editor of America's New Swing Region, Changing Politics and Demographics in the Mountain West. I'm Angie Coiro. You're listening to In Deep.
Everybody's scared, everybody's nervous, everybody's feeling uptight. Nobody knows when the hammer's coming down, might be today, tomorrow, or tonight. Everybody's talking about 1929, 80 long years ago. In the 70s, we waited for some gas on a line. Man, that seems like next to nothing now, you know. piece of cake. I bought myself a house over in the valley, thought I had a money-making machine. Can't sell the place now, I'm in a dark alley, living the American dream. You know that job I always said that I hated? Well, yesterday they gave me the sack. Loving your work is so damn overrated, I sure wish to God I had the job back. How? Check out the illegals standing on the corner, watching all the cars go by. Lord, they used to look bored, but now they're looking hungry. You can see the desperation in their eyes. I guess you're glad you got yourself that college education. That ought to come in handy one day. I just read about a guy stuck up a filling station on account of college loans he had to pay. Payback time. Oh, it's pretty bad here, but it's really bad there. In Iceland, there's a riot going on. In L.A., they're shutting down the DMV on Friday. Now the weekend feels a little too long. You got depression and recession.
We're spending this hour on In Deep Radio talking about the outreach that the Republicans make. They have some effort to talk to constituencies that they actually work against. It's a very difficult position for them. They want to get the Hispanic vote, but their articles, their ideas, and even their very language around immigration is repellent. They try to do outreach when they talk to the LGBT groups, but of course they in some cases even are in favor of criminalizing LGBT behavior or existence. So one of the things that we uncovered as we worked to develop this hour was what had actually happened behind the scenes with the National Organization for Marriage. That is the group that has been repeatedly pushing for marriage to have one definition, a heterosexual coupling, male and female only, with not much distinction, I might add, between that which is deigned by God and that which is recognized by the United States of America. Well, it turns out that not only are the ideas of the National Organization for Marriage on the repellent side, but some of their techniques, as revealed in memos this past week, have been truly dismal. Let's talk to Kevin Nix, the campaign media director for the Human Rights Campaign and HRC. Kevin and a number of others work to expose these ideas from NOM. Kevin, thanks for taking time with us.
Thanks for having me.
What did these memos uncover that was so startling?
Well, we went down to the courthouse in May in Portland Monday, and a court had ordered these documents, secret documents from 2008 and 2009, to be unsealed. So we went there, got them, photocopied them, put them online, and distributed them. And what's in those documents is actually, like you said, startling. I mean, it lays out their tactics of racially dividing and exploiting communities and states in order to achieve their ends, which is, of course, stopping marriage equality. But some of the language used, for example, was, quote, to drive a wedge between gays and blacks, end quote. The same applied to Latinos. So their strategy is, you know, somewhat jaw-dropping, and at least written on paper. We've known it all along. Mm-hmm. This is how this group operates, but it's a whole different sort of ballgame when you see it in writing in some of their own internal documents.
It's such a great deal of cynicism there. I mean, I don't want to play naive. I mean, politicians often treat people as chess pieces, but the sheer cynicism of this saying, you know, take the one oppressed minority, the black people, you take another oppressed minority, LGBT, and you divide and conquer. You try to set the one against the other. It goes beyond playing chess.
Yeah, it's just cynical, ugly politics at its core. And, you know, the idea here is to we can sort of disagree on the public policy issue of marriage equality, but that's no reason to divide and conquer families and people within communities along any lines, much less racial or ethnic lines.
How effective were they at achieving this goal they had set out?
Well, look, I mean, if you look at how NOM has played in the state since 2009, so that would be Maine, North Carolina now, Maryland now, and some other states last year. I mean, you see pretty clearly that, and in New York especially last year, that they, no question, emphasized repeatedly in their sort of public face, their public messaging, and exploited African Americans and Latinos in their campaigning. And whether that's, you know, in some of their press releases or their videos or their rallies, especially in New York, you have Brian Brown walking hand in hand, you know, with Senator Ruben Diaz as their face. I think it's quite telling that the evidence actually is overwhelming. We're putting something together now to sort of document that. You know, the strategy was 09, and so how does that strategy been executed since 09? And we'll release something shortly.
I'm really looking forward to seeing that. One thing that's surprising about NAM is they keep returning to techniques, strategies, and rhetoric that have repeatedly been shown to be inaccurate or outright lies. And I'm referring this time to one of their most recent tweets on Twitter. They posted, "Support developing for plural marriage across the U.S. This is next if we don't stand strong on marriage's definition." It sounds almost archaic. It's right up there with them saying, if we let gay people marry each other, we have to let our dogs marry our cats. We have to let people marry horses. Does this have any traction with the average voter at all?
Look, I think that, you know, they run the risk of going too far. And I think, you know, going overboard in their rhetoric. And I think that they've, you know, over time, over the past 4 years, they were founded in 07. I think they've had to draw back a little bit and rein in some of their, you know, over the top, you know, ridiculous, patently false arguments in order to continue to be taken seriously, whether it's in Washington, you know, on Capitol Hill, or whether it's in these different states. So I think that, you know, the fact that the country has moved significantly at a lightning speed on marriage equality since Prop 8, but especially the past couple of years, now we see a majority of Americans support it, then that's, you know, that's dented, that sort of slowed their sort of march toward their goals of stopping equality, and they, you know, need to sort of adjust to that. And that means tweaking their language a little bit. You saw recently they even said they came out for civil unions, which in New Hampshire, which of course goes against their fundamental principles. So again, it's back to that cynical, do whatever it takes to win proposition that they follow.
I'm talking to Kevin Nix with the Human Rights Campaign. He's their campaign media director. I get the feeling that those who are in power in Washington take no heed of the public sentiment that you've just been talking about, that the public support has really rallied for marriage equality. And yet we had word that Speaker Boehner, I'm saying yesterday because our show records during the week for weekend broadcast, yesterday Boehner appointed one of the NAM co-founders to a federal commission for, of all things, the International Religious Freedom Commission, which addresses, quote, the challenges of religious extremism, intolerance, and repression throughout the world. Now, unless he decided to put Robert George in that seat to function as Exhibit A of extremism, intolerance, and repression, this is an appalling slight.
Right. Robert George is not exactly the sort of paragon of freedom, liberty, and non-discrimination, right? The speaker appointed him to that position. That actually sort of puts the speaker he's aligning himself more with the extremist right wing of the party by picking Robert George, who, as you said, is a co-founder, chairman emeritus of NAM, and who actually moderated a Republican primary debate last year.
And I guess I don't understand the mentality behind this. Is this essentially flipping the bird at those people who are in favor of marriage equality, saying, look, you don't get to win, we're in power, regardless of what public sentiment is? Now, how do you translate this?
Oh, look, here's what I think. So, you know, about the Republican Party, I think that, you know, also among Republicans. So if you look at, this is sort of the sweet spot of the whole marriage story in the past, I'd say, year. So you have four Republicans in the New York legislature who helped put the bill over the finish line last year and brought marriage equality to the Empire State. In New Hampshire, a right-leaning, fully Republican legislature, last week that legislature voted down, said, no, we don't want to repeal the state's popular marriage law. Marriage equality is legal there and has been. So Republicans are even now standing up and seeing, you know, this this sort of doesn't fly anymore. We still have a ways to go. But if you look at sort of Republicans, you know, more Republicans, depending on the state you're in, you know, the tide is turning even no matter what party you're in, right? Mm-hmm. I think, though, that, you know, Washington, the government takes a while to catch up to where the people are.
One of our themes this hour is probing how Republicans try to reach out to minorities whose policies they're actually offensive to, whose policies they might in some cases actually criminalize. What have you seen coming from the Republican Party to make any kind of overtures to LGBT or even just Joe Schmo straight person who has LGBT friends or family? Do you see them making any effort at all? Do they appear to have written that off?
Well, I think that there's some efforts within the party. We don't certainly don't see it now during primary season, but I do think there are efforts within the party nationally and in certain state legislatures. But yeah, I mean, there's no question that this Congress in Washington is anti-LGBT and, you know, has no desire to move the ball of progress down the field.
Is it clear which would be more dangerous for HRC and its intents and its goals of the Republican candidates that have offered themselves on the primary ticket? Is it clear that there's one more dangerous than another, or are they all pretty much of a muchness, as they used to say?
Well, look, I think that they're, you know, I think Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich are clearly obvious sort of examples that are sort of extremely anti-gay in their rhetoric and in their policy positions. Mitt Romney, may sound better rhetorically, but as far as we're concerned, he flip-flops on LGBT issues just like he does on healthcare and other issues. So it's really hard to trust and know where he really stands. So, you know, to have someone that you can't trust and goes back and forth on his, at one point in 1994, Mitt Romney was saying he's do more for the gay community than Ted Kennedy. Right. Mm-hmm. And now he's wanting to rescind Don't Ask, Don't Tell and to and supports the Defense of Marriage Act, which would make marriage equality unconstitutional. So I think that Mitt Romney's record is very clear as being anti-LGBT.
Kevin, I really thank you for the time going through this with us and great work on getting the nom memos out in front of everybody.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Nix is the campaign media director for the Human Rights Campaign. You can find his work at hrc.org, and we'll link directly to his pages from our website at indeepradio.com. Well, now that we've talked about a little bit of the policy with Kevin Nix and talked about the impact of the nom papers coming out and just how far into the political system they've managed to entrench themselves, let's get a look from the front lines. Stuart Gaffney has been with his husband, John Lewis, 24 years now, but they weren't, of course, able to marry in the United States until 2008, June 17, 2008, a landmark day when couples were lined up around San Francisco City Hall in the rain, waiting for that chance to wed. They did that, and then, of course, those marriages were called into question, and he has been at the forefront of the lawsuit to make sure that that marriage stays real and legal. Stuart Gaffney, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to get your personal input on when you heard about what happened with the National Organization for Marriage and the way that they were effectively, very cynically, trying to drive a wedge between black communities and LGBT communities in order to weaken their strength in the marriage issue.
I was really saddened when I read these documents. I think we've sensed these tactics from their organization, but we've never seen their anti-equality agenda laid bare like this. And it's so mean-spirited and so cynical, and it really is sad, because we believe that the marriage equality movement, first and foremost, is actually about our shared desire to love another person in a committed fashion, and that's something that we all can understand as human beings. We really strive to connect with other people around what's important about love and equality and marriage. And to see this agenda to divide and conquer really made me very sad to see what we're facing.
One of the contrasts that's come up as we've had these conversations this hour is we talked to Rui Teixeira, and he pointed out, you know, that there is still some ostensible effort on the part of Republicans of the right to reach out to Hispanic, Latino communities, even though, of course, their policies are definitely not made to cultivate that friendship. On the other hand, when you look at what's happened with the right, the Republicans, and the LGBT communities, it almost seems more like they've just given that up. They're not doing any reaching across the waters. They're not trying to engage them at all. They're not going to count on any of those votes come election time. Am I reading that correctly, according to your take?
Well, with Marriage Equality USA, we are working very hard to both have the universal message of love and marriage that I spoke about, but also to do work in specific communities. For example, my parents were an interracial couple and actually faced laws against their own marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court overturned all remaining bans on interracial marriage in 1967. And in 1967, that was the first time our family was legal as a family in all 50 states. Mm. So we really believe it's important to remind people of the commonalities that we share in the struggles to overcome all sorts of discrimination, but specifically discrimination in marriage. And that is something that can be understood in general, but also for specific communities.
Well, I'm looking at John Boehner's move to appoint the co-founder of NAM to a federal commission on, this is just hysterical if you have that kind of sense of humor, the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. And he's just, you know, nominated or appointed a NAM co-founder to that commission. Is that an indication that there is going to be no effort on behalf of the right to even try to cultivate some commonality with the message that you're talking about, which is that this is about the things that we all hold to be sacred?
Well, I wish I could be more optimistic, but reading the language of the NAM document, I was just really struck by how just bald-faced they were about wanting to create dissension, to cause conflict between groups, and also to use really just, I thought, kind of shocking language about how they talked about the process of assimilation for Latinos, or how they even talked about finding spokespeople that they called non-cognitive, which really is just kind of an insulting term for the types of people they wanted to be messengers in certain communities. So it's very disrespectful, I have to say, what they're putting forward. And I just can't imagine how this is going to further their anti-equality cause in any way.
When you look forward to the election coming up, do you think that the issues of marriage equality, that other issues that might be of importance to the LGBT communities, do you see these taking a front seat in any way?
Well, we've seen for the first time national polls showing majority support for the freedom to marry now. And it's just in time because we're seeing so far in 2012 a record-breaking movement in Washington State and in New Jersey and in Maryland to implement marriage equality. But in up to seven states, it's going to be on the ballot later this year. So it's... we really believe that fundamental right, like marriage, shouldn't be a popularity contest and should not be up for a popular vote. But given that it is, we actually are in the position of needing to ask our neighbors and friends to vote for our equal marriage rights. So it is going to be a big issue this year, definitely.
Stuart Gaffney, I really appreciate the time. And I appreciate, too, everything that you've done for the movement to bring people equal rights. It seems so basic, and yet it's been a big fight, and you've really been at the front of it. I thank you so much, and I hope you got the energy and the pizzazz to continue in it, because you've done a great job.
Thank you so much. John and I are celebrating 25 years together.
Wow!
So that gives us energy right there. We love talking about love and marriage, so thank you so much.
You got it. Stuart Gaffney, will put a link to his work on our website at indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Coiro.
Wasting my time for you.
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Curro. Now, we have spent this hour examining the uneasy coexistence between the Republicans and the right with the constituencies that they live amongst. On the one hand, as we heard from Ruth Teixeira, they could really use Hispanic votes, and they make some efforts to make nice there. But while the National Organization for Marriage goes the route of undermining, dividing, and conquering in their fight against marriage equality. So how do the Republicans deal with an outspoken gay candidate for the presidential nomination? The Republican presidential nomination. And that is the role of my next and return guest, Fred Carger, who, although you may not hear too much about it, has consistently and is in fact staying on the campaign trail week after week. And that's where we got him on the phone. His best showing so far, by the way, is Puerto Rico, where he came in fifth. Fred, welcome back. It's so good to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks, Angie. Always good to be on your show.
Now, aside from this whole gay thing, your Republican bona fides are intact. You have worked with the tobacco industry. You fought the smoking bans in California. You are against gun control. You attended AIPAC. You are hardly a crazy radical leftist. So is it just that you are an out gay man who's fighting for marriage equality that puts you outside the Republican norm, or is there more going on there?
Well, no, I've been like this way my whole life. I was raised by a pair of moderate Republican parents who had great caring for people. I was a child of the 60s and the civil rights movement, so we were kind of peripherally involved in that, and they just taught me good values to look out for people in need, whether it's government or individuals that we could help. And so I'm a different kind of Republican now. I'm not such an anomaly to the Republican Party I grew up with, though, which was much more moderate and wasn't all divisive and welcomed everyone into the Republican Party.
You know what's interesting about that is I talk to a lot of people who either are or were Republican, and they consider themselves moderate. They feel like they don't have a party. And the more time goes by, the more I think they're in the quiet majority. So why do you think that's not reflected in the people we have running for office? You know, you have Santorum, who is so against equality in marriage, and you have Romney, who does seem to be out of touch with anyone outside the upper privileged white circle. Why is the moderate Republican not represented?
Well, the moderate is, through Fred Carger. I even use the M word in my commercials. Ron Paul, as a pretty full libertarian in so many ways, I think represents probably 75% of the moderate Republican viewpoint. I hear it time and time again on the campaign trail, my parents were moderates, I used to be a Republican. And what's happened, the leaders of the party, not the party itself, but the leaders who've done a takeover, starting at the city and county level to the state Republican parties to the national Republican Party, want this purity pledge where you either agree with 9 out of 10 social issues that they believe in or you're not allowed in. Well, that's stupid. We're a minority party. We should be welcoming everyone in as Ronald Reagan did. And he was a great compromiser. He got along with Democrats. He brought an entire new young generation into the Republican Party after Watergate, when it was as uncool to be a Republican if you're under 30 then as ever. And so we need to just drop all these terrible social positions. People like Rick Santorum are doing tremendous damage long-term to the Republican Party for his own selfish interest in this cycle, and I think we've got a great opportunity to do this if we would just start looking at Fred Carger, who is on the California ballot, and others who speak out in support of inclusion of everyone in the Republican Party.
Tell me, as much as you can, and I understand there are some things that a candidate can't speak of that happen behind the scenes, but insofar as you can, what happens with your efforts to be included in the debates when they're televised, your efforts to get on the ballot? I mean, what do you hear about why we're not hearing, and when I say we, I mean the larger American public, we're not hearing of Fred Carger as we do Rick Santorum, as we do Mitt Romney, as we do Newt Gingrich?
Well, it's interesting. I started this as a first-time candidate 25 months ago, and about 23 months ago in New Orleans, I announced my intention to run. You've got to do things very carefully until you file, so I was an intention to run. But for all intents and purposes, I was announcing my candidacy, and I said I have one goal, and that is to get in a debate. And as a historic candidate who is the first openly gay candidate to run for president of either major political party, openly gay, it would be very significant. And I worked very hard to do that. And part of the, it's a catch-22, you have to do well in the polls in order to get included in the debate. So the first Fox News debate in Greensboro, South Carolina last May, I was excluded from because the criteria Fox set up was you had to be at 5%, 1% in five national debates. Well, at that point, I'd only been included in one national poll, I meant, and so I was at 1%, but I hadn't met their qualifications. Well, the next time Fox had a debate, it was in Iowa, Ames, Iowa, in conjunction with the straw poll in August. Well, this time I'd gotten enough attention, I'd been included in enough polls that I was at 1% or higher in, I think, six or seven national polls. So I sent Rupert Murdoch a letter thanking him. Where do I report? What details do I need to know for your debate? Well, they changed the rules on me, and they even told that to the Des Moines Register. So I filed a complaint against Murdoch personally with the Federal Election Commission. It's a very serious charge. I didn't do it lightly, but when you change the rules to keep me out, I will not roll over and play dead. So I am waiting to hear from the FEC on that, and because I was excluded from that one debate, I have been left in the dust to some extent because that has been the measure of success this year. We saw with Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, so many people who weren't known who became rock stars overnight. They didn't sustain their celebrity because there are a lot of flaws, but I had hoped to do that. I'm now hopeful that as this field narrows, we're about to lose Newt Gingrich. There'll be only four of us who are viable candidates, only four on the California ballot, and if it comes down to three or four candidates, I should be included in that next debate.
I'm talking to Fred Karger. He is running for the Republican nomination for president. He works as an American political consultant. He's a gay rights activist, and he's also a watchdog. And we'll put a link up to his website on our website at indeepradio.com. Tell me how overt the messages are that you get, Fred, that being out and a gay activist are working against you as a Republican candidate.
Well, what I found interesting, Angie, is the Republican Party at the national level and state and county level has welcomed me almost 100% with open arms, including a meeting I had last year after I filed with Reince Priebus, the new chair, the vice chair, Sharon Day, and Jeff Larson, the executive director. They've included me in all the privileges of the RNC, all the lists, all their meetings, all the research. And they've been very, very good. Some of the state chairmen who could have put me on the ballot, three in Massachusetts, in Florida, and in North Carolina, refused just arbitrary decisions, even though the RNC recommended I be on ballots. So that's been tough. I've also received a tremendous amount of, a big cold shoulder from the LGBT leadership. Mm-hmm. Certain organizations that have, because I am a Republican, even though I'm a tried and true activist and certainly to the left of President Obama on several issues like marriage equality, they've shunned me. And that has been the most hurtful of all because, as you mentioned, I've been aggressive. I'm a watchdog. I've gone up against the Mormon Church and gotten them investigated. National Organization for Marriage, I've gotten them investigated, which is what the source of these papers that came out, these documents this week. It was a result of the investigation that I'm responsible for in Maine. These were subpoenaed documents by the Attorney General of Maine that are now, the seal was lifted by the federal judge. So I've done a lot for the movement, and I would hope for some support, although I understand because so many Republicans, particularly in elective office, have done so much damage to this gay civil rights movement.
You know, I was really remiss, and I knew that you were instrumental in getting those papers released. And when I did talk to a representative of the Human Rights Campaign today, I should have asked him about that, about why the notice that you were the man behind the release isn't more widely touted. And what I plan to do, I'm going to email him and ask him about, you know, about acknowledging your role. And I'm going to put that on my blog. So I'll follow up on that because that's really interesting to me. You sound almost like a man without a country. I mean, if the LGBT community is shunning you because you're a Republican and the Republicans are shunning you because you're gay, I mean, this is, when I think about Michelle Bachmann being on a stage answering questions or Sarah Palin being on a stage answering questions as a potential Republican presidential candidate, and you're not, there's a real disconnect there.
Well, thank you. I think I was a little intimidated. I did go to that first Fox News debate in Greenville last May, and 3,000 people in the auditorium, live, televised, and I was invited to participate in their primary, but not in the debate. And so it's a pretty scary prospect. But in this last 10, 11 months, I've really gained my confidence. I've become much more conversant on all the domestic and international issues. I've traveled to the Middle East. So I'm very comfortable now and would be ready to take on these candidates, even though they've been in 20 debates, most of them. So I do have a constituency out there. Those two we talked about, the Republicans, more conservative Republicans, the LGBT community, particularly the activists, are not too fond of what I'm doing. But where I was this evening is a classic example. I spoke to about 40 students at Towson University, which is a state school, beautiful, beautiful campus, about 40 minutes from Baltimore, and they welcomed me. They could care less about my sexuality. They're concerned about jobs, education, particularly interested in my microloan program as part of my job plan to help entrepreneurs right out of school, out of work, starting their own businesses. So those are the people that rally around me, not unlike Ron Paul, who has run 3 times. He had a tough time. He didn't get in the debates the first or even second time he ran as a member of Congress. So I've got a constituency. I beat Ron Paul in Puerto Rico. I spoke the language down there a little bit in a commercial, literally and figuratively, in talking about statehood for the Commonwealth, and also English not being the first language, which it is not now. I spoke the language. I was endorsed by the number one radio show host down there, talk show host there, Carmen Jovet, who endorsed me, was so gracious, and I think that is one of the reasons I did so well. So I take a different message, as you've mentioned, Angie, and it's resonating particularly with younger people, and that's what really excites me.
Well, you know, what's also resonating with younger people is the Occupy Wall Street movement. A lot of kids are growing up now. You and I are roughly the same age, and we grew up with a certain idea of how much opportunity was available to us, and we had a certain belief that there was flexibility within the class lines. And younger people, whether they identify as Republican or independent or libertarian, whatever, more and more they're recognizing the huge discrepancy in income and in holdings that there are, and that there's less flexibility across the class lines. Is that something that you find the Republican Party, among whom you still count yourself, do you find them willing to discuss that at all? Because I think that's going to resonate with the next generation.
Well, I applaud the Occupy movement. I visited my first one in New Hampshire. I went to Occupy Wall Street the same day Jesse Jackson did, who's one of my heroes. I got to hang out with him a little bit. And I think, and I went to Los Angeles as well, and I've been to others. But it sent a very loud message, and look what happened. They already had success with a student loan issue. And now we met, I was actually on the RT television yesterday with one of the leaders of the Occupy DC movement, and they are now doing a whole array of things, not just taking over a city park, but through the internet and action. And I think that's great. And my goal is for prosperity across this country, not to dilute those who are successful, but to encourage those who aren't as successful to be successful, to be comfortable. That obviously is not all in life, but it can certainly help. And I think that if we create this optimism in this country, as Reagan did very successfully, as I hoped Obama would do, but he's been, I think, a bit of a disappointment on that front for his first term, that we need to bring back this American spirit. And if we can do that and lift this country up and put America back to work and create new entrepreneurs, we can do anything. Our options are open for this generation. And that's what inspires me tonight at Towson University. These students who are all graduating soon are very nervous, and we need to give them a president who will talk up this country, who will talk up the opportunity here and create a lot of opportunity for graduating students and people that are dropping out of high school and people that are hoping for a better life than they had from their parents. And that's what this American dream is all about.
You know, I'm having flashbacks to at my last show I had as a semi-regular guest, I had the leader of the Log Cabin Republicans in California. And periodically, I would have to just ask him, why are you a Republican? And I'm flashing back to that now because I'm hearing that you can relate to Jesse Jackson. I'm hearing that you're open to the ideas of Occupy Wall Street. And I look at what the Republican Party has become, which you and I have touched on already. And let me ask you this as my final question. Why are you a Republican? What is it about you and the policies you appreciate and what you stand for that you still think the Republican Party stands for?
Well, I am a firm believer in our two-party system, and I think that the problem right now we have is that the two parties are just so many miles apart, and it's become so personal in Sacramento, in every state capital, and in the Congress. And I want to try and bring those two sides together. I was a maxed out donor to Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. I've supported Democrats. I'm proud of that. Many of these politicians don't even associate with Democrats. They live in their little cocoon. They don't know any Democrats if they're Republicans, and don't know any Republicans if they're Democrats. We need to work together as a country. I think that's important, that we have some moderation in the Republican Party who can relate to Democrats, who can speak that same language and get along. And Reagan was the master at that. First thing he did as president was to invite the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, over to the White House, and they bonded and they became friends and they got things done. And so my moderation, my centrist positions, I think, as a leader in the Republican Party, and certainly if I'm fortunate enough to be president, I think I could do great work in bringing this, the politicians together, which will then bring the country together. And I have no greater goal than that.
Fred Karger, it's a joy to talk to you, and I applaud your basic decency. I'm sure there's an awful lot you and I disagree on, but by gosh, I hope more people on both sides of the aisle start to become this civil with each other. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie.
Fred Karger is running for the Republican presidential nomination. And thank you for tuning in to In Deep. You can follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio or on Facebook as In Deep with Angie Cuero. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Matt Fidler is our engineer. Our intern is Forrest Phillips. Our theme is by Big Troubles. David Gans provides our closing music. Visit us online at indeep.com for web extras. And we are coming back next week to once again go In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero.
Occupation with other people's private parts. They want us to do what they say, but I'd rather live my own damn way. We'll take our culture back someday, but it's gonna get worse before it gets better. It's gonna get worse before it gets better. It's gonna get worse before it gets better, but I know it's gonna get better. Yes, I know it's gonna get better, 'cause it almost always does. I can't say much about the who and how, but I believe it just because. Day by day our bonds unweave, mammon gloats as nature grieves. Oh.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy. And you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Cuero. Thanks, and we will see you then. You are listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.